All right, welcome to Orphan Radio. This is Matt again. I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina. Today I'm with Jim McSorley, who is a detective sergeant with the LAPD. You might know him as Knocko Nolan on social media, but you probably also saw him in the Netflix documentary series Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel that came out a month or two ago. But we're going to talk about a bunch of different topics today. I want to start off with your background. I know you grew up in New York. What made you decide to become a cop when you were younger? Was it, did you have cops in your family, or how did that all get started?
You know what, as the years go on, you become, as you understand yourself more and more, you know, it reveals the layers. But like the initial, just going back as like a 12-year-old, 13-year-old me, what initially got me open to policing was the iconic film French Connection with Gene Hackman. And I did have family members on the police department, uncle, great grandfather, what have you. So that was, I was always around that culture, the military culture, my dad being an Army Ranger and whatnot. So there was always that lineage of protectors and you know, forward warriors, you know, just taking a hold of something and being aggressive with it and finding a solution. So that surface level of the 12, 13-year-old me, that was initially it. But then as years go on, you find out where it's kind of like a surrogate family. I was an only child. So the extension of the police department's a family, and you're with a small unit, and that's a really good representation of a small family unit and brothers that I'd never had really. And it goes on from there of, you know, of what's in your DNA and finding out, you know, your past and that'll predict your future. So that's, I don't know if it chooses you or you choose it, maybe a little bit of both, but yeah, that's a lot of it, is not wanting to work indoors in a sedentary, you know, profession, and, you know, just playing cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians for real. I mean, for me, it doesn't get any better than that, of having fun, but doing a very worthwhile mission. It's just, it's the ultimate win.
Did you join the NYPD like right out of high school, or how did that all happen?
Yeah, you have to be 21 in order to be a policeman in the United States. But I was a reserve officer before you could be reserve unarmed under 21. So I did that. I think I want to say when I turned 18 or 17, it was pretty young.
Okay.
And then once my first major police department was Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD. I did that for a few years and then came back to New York in 2000, 2003, 2004, around there. And then ended up coming back to LA. So I kind of did a little pinball career, kind of career ADD. And I've been here in LA ever since. So,
yeah. Why did you originally start out there?
You had a good buddy of mine, drummer, best friend, Bill. And, you know, we were heavily influenced by, you know, musicians and music and the scene and all that. And somehow we found out that LAPD was recruiting. And so you talk about movies and pop culture, you know, you guys on Orphan, I mean, that's a bread and butter. So combined love of cinema and punk rock, metal, aggressive music, everything coming from the West Coast that I loved, and the outdoors, where I'm a water guy, I live at the beach, so all these things presented itself, and it just sounded too good to be true. I'm like, yeah, and I was always a student of history when it came to all those segments that I mentioned before, and as well as the police department out here. So I heard that, and I was like, yeah, let's give it a shot. Came out here, like the first day we were swimming in Malibu, saw dolphins, I was like, yeah, this is it. Let's do it. And ended up coming, getting on and checking in out here in LA in 96.
Okay. And so, what was your rise through the ranks? Like, do you start as just like a patrol cop, or how does that work? How you got to where you are now?
Yeah, you start off, you come out of the academy, do a year of probation as a rookie, and you're saddled up with a field training officer, a veteran guy. And, you know, you answer your 911 calls, and that's the ground floor of policing. That's the foundation. and everything else is built off of that, and its support elements, more or less. Those are the guys doing the heavy lifting. And so as you're working your way through those rookie years, you come in contact with all different types of people, whether it's FTOs or other influential people in your career, and ended up linking up with another East Coast guy, Boston guy, another music fan, a guy named Bob Diemer. He does a lot of acting stuff now as he's coming down to his tail end career. He's worked with Michael Mann, and he became a mentor and kind of steered me into all these different avenues that interested that got him open. So I got into narcotics investigations, gang investigations, white gangs, prison gang type of encounters and investigations. So that kind of set me off on that path, that was kind of the flavor. But in my mind already, I wanted to be like Gene Hackman. I wanted to be a plainclothes detective working in a small unit in a citywide function, tackling major investigations and having a great partner and having fun and just kicking ass on the streets and doing it right. And to present day, that's what I'm doing. And it's been a great ride. So that's kind of the apprenticeship, is, you know, working in uniform, then starting to hit these different specialized units throughout the way of what I get the pipelines working as a detective. So you're working like gang enforcement. So I got to work out crash unit, which you might have seen in Colors with Bob Duvall and Sean Penn. Mm-hmm. That depicted like LAPD's gang enforcement. And then I worked Vice. So going after, you know, pimps and dealing with prostitutes on the street. And then work with career criminal unit. So again, plain clothes, small units, and just building up that resume and just, you know, and just gathering mentors and learning as much as I can, and just having that, you know, being a sponge and just soaking up everything I can. And just, it was pretty much like 24/7 was the job. And it was unbelievable. It just, you know, because you're a blank slate. So you're just taking it all in, and then little by little building it up, then you make detective. And then you get promoted from there, become a supervisor, and then you're supervising other detectives. And you know, that brings me to present day, where I'm working a fugitive apprehension team, and I'm supervising a squad of cops and detectives. And we're going after, you know, from murderers to wife beaters to gang members, everything in between. If they have a felony warrant and they committed a crime and they're hot, we're going after them.
So when you first started out there, when you were a patrolman, what was your, like, where was your area in LA?
I checked into Hollywood Division. So, you know, where the Hollywood sign is, Hollywood Walk of Fame. And in the 90s back then, it was completely different from what it was now. It more resembled like the nitty gritty, like Times Square era of New York City, which I loved. You know, drug dealers everywhere, you know, gangsters, homeless, you know, fugitives. And it was that dichotomy of the super rich in the Hollywood Hills and then the super poor, your gang members and drifters coming from out of state, and, you know, and then a little bit of in between of just your everyday normal crime. So it was nasty, it was dingy, and it was awesome.
I feel like a lot of tourists, when they go to LA for the first time, they don't really understand what Hollywood is like. You know, I don't know if it's cleaned up, but the first time I went there, I was 16. So it was like 1994. And I was there with my folks, and I was like, whoa, this is pretty dark and dirty down here.
Yes. Yeah. It's pretty gnarly. It kind of reminds me of, it was like that. You ever see that George C. Scott movie? I forgot what the title off the top of my head, but he's roaming around Hollywood. I think he's like looking for his daughter.
Oh, is it Hardcore?
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great movie. But yeah, it's just, you know, once you go beyond that superficial level of what you see on television, and it's nasty. You know, you're just dealing with all the fallout of people that come to LA and just get sucked into the vortex of, you know, of griminess.
Yeah. In your experience, what do you think were the big differences between working for LAPD and NYPD, like culturally?
Sure. Yeah. NYPD, were a homegrown organization, meaning there's generations of us like I was, you know, it's a lineage thing. And the guys are very almost, you know, we're like townies, you know, most of the guys that work there, you know, never left New York City, a lot of them. So it was so ingrained in the population that we're the police department and the people very symbiotic, you know, blends into one. You know, with this at the peak, it was like 41,000 cops in just NYPD, not counting all the other agencies. So everyone had a family member or a friend on the police department. So I think community-wise, it was more cohesive because they understood the police department, as opposed to LAPD, which is a lot of out-of-state people, including myself, and homegrown mixed in. But LA being LA, very few people live in the city. I think like 90% of us live outside the city, if not more. So there's a little bit more of a disconnect between the people and the police department. And so if you don't have as much things in common with the people that you're policing, you can kind of tend to treat them differently. And
yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, treating family members and then strangers. You're going to treat people usually differently. Not that it's right or wrong, you know, that's up to the individual, but there's definitely going to be a difference. So LA, it was kind of had a reputation of almost being like a mercenary outfit. You know, you come in, you come out, you know, like a Vietnam War type of thing. You know, you're coming in on choppers and you're getting the hell out. And kind of through the years, we gained like that siege mentality of approach to policing, for better or worse. A lot of it was by necessity, because at our height, we had maybe less than 10,000. And the city of LA is gigantic. Huge population, and like I said, in New York we had 40,000. So I had to be very proactive and aggressive and address the little things before it became the big things, so that I can have a blowback effect on the community and change the course of history, sometimes not for the better. So it was always regarded as a very paramilitary organization, very professional, very image based. So everyone, a lot of guys that were veterans, has a very close proximity to Camp Pendleton, who's where the Marines train. So we had a huge amount of Marines. So a lot of guys just coming straight from the Marine Corps to the police department. It was an easy blend. And that type of mentality was promoted. And so it became very professional. Whereas when I was in NYPD, I derisively call it room, but we were almost like a softball team with guns, you know. Very just, hey, whatever, you know, go with the flow, have a piece of pizza, and then, you know, deal with people on the street, the very neighborhood, like very blue collar. But we got the job done because we had a lot of numbers, and we didn't have to, you know, stomp on everybody out in the streets to make an impression. And whereas in LA, there wasn't many of us out there, so if we had an encounter, we had to be forceful with it sometimes. So.
Okay. So that was a question I had too, is LA County is enormous. So if you work for LAPD, anything that happens in the entire county could come to you.
Right. Right. The geography is gigantic. There's, you know, very few bridges and, you know, waterways to create boundaries and dividing lines, so like it is in New York City, you know, Manhattan Island and, you know, Queens, basically an island and what have you. So it's a lot different geography. So you could be driving, you know, for 10 minutes and pass through three other different jurisdictions and police departments. So, yeah, it's pretty scattered, you know, population-wise and jurisdiction-wise.
And then LA County Sheriff's is a totally separate thing, right?
Totally separate thing. They deal with the courts, the jails, and the unincorporated areas in LA County, and then they're like a contract agency.
So is a lot of LA County still kind of rural, or at least the outskirts, or is it all kind of built up at this point?
It's been built up drastically, but yeah, there's a ton of LA County's portions. They're just, you know, desert, just wastelands.
Right.
Very rural. And that's primarily the sheriff's jurisdiction.
Okay.
Ours is the city, very dense. I think there's been reports that we're actually more dense than New York City right now, which is crazy. But the skyscrapers and apartments being built nonstop out here. So
yeah,
lend some credence to that.
You brought up colors earlier, and I've been really fascinated by crime, gangs, police work, especially in LA. My older brother showed me Colors when it came out when I was about 10 years old. How do you think the overall gang problem and the crime related to gangs in Los Angeles, how does it compare now than it did like late 80s through the mid 90s, when it was like it was in the news constantly? Like, is it better, worse, or is it just different these days?
It's definitely better. But I think a lot of that has to do with, I attribute it to the internet. So you fast, you know, rewind back to the 80s and 90s. I'm a kid in a poor neighborhood in South Central, and all I know is my four square blocks around me. And if that happens to be inhabited by gang members and drug dealers and, you know, other criminals, that's my norm. That's my barometer. So I'm going to look to them, since I'm coming from a fractured family, for role models and mentors and just extended family. So that's all I know. He goes, that's where all I can go. I go to school and come back to the neighborhood, and that's it. Now you throw in the advent of the internet, and you could see beyond your neighborhood. You could see that there's a life outside of what's out happening outside your window. And kids are seeing that, and they're like, wow, I'm going to do what, you know, whatever, you name it, whoever's out there doing something positive. Wow, that looks like fun. I want to get involved in skateboarding. I'd see all these videos, and there's no one out there, but I'm going to make it happen. I want to listen to this type of music, whatever outlet it is. That computer's your portal to something better than what you're seeing.
Yeah.
And kids are now making their own decisions instead of just being a product of their environment. So who wants to be locked up? Who wants to get chased by the police? Who wants to get killed? Who wants to get beat up? I mean, very few people. That's abnormal behavior. So now these kids have an outlet to express themselves and to see other opportunities. I think that was the biggest game changer as I see for the youth that I encounter on a daily basis.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I watched the original Paradise Lost documentary that came out in 96 about the West Memphis Three, the original case, and that Joe Berlinger, who you just worked with on the Netflix series, who directed it. Have you ever seen his original, the Paradise Lost movie?
Long time ago.
And I rewatched that again recently, and it happened in like 93, and the trial was in 94, and just those kids were so cut off from the rest of the world. You know, they lived in this really backwards, messed up town that was poor and crime ridden, and they just didn't know that anything else even existed out there. So it's probably, I guess it's the same in big cities too.
Yeah, we're just a, you know, product of our surroundings, but now we're not just surrounded by that. You know, we have this thing in our hand or in our lap. And we can escape all that and see what's really out there. Some choices.
Yeah. So speaking of that, the vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, you have experience working on Skid Row. And is that the reason why they kind of tapped you to be one of the people interviewed in that?
Yes. One of the historians that was on there, Kim Cooper, she has a tour group called Esoteric. And they do all like true crime, noirish type tours in downtown LA. So they hit her up and said, hey, do you happen to know any policemen that worked in Skid Row? And we've been tight for many years and collaborated. And I've had her on my previous, on the Delta Bravo show. I used to do a video cast with Danny Boyd O'Connor from now in the Outsiders house. And we had them on as guests. So I popped up in her mind and said, yeah, I know my friend Nako. And I could call him up. And yeah, I went down there. I thought it was just going to be a little indie documentary. Maybe a few thousand punters would see it. And then as it morphed, little did I know, it got sold to Netflix. And then Ron Howard, a.k.a. Opie from Happy Days, and Brian Grazer were the, you know, producers and the, you know, EPs to it. And I was like, wow, this is going to be crazy. I had no idea.
Yeah. How would you explain Skid Row on a day-to-day, like what's it like day-to-day for somebody who's never been there before?
It's primarily, it's almost like being in an open air insane asylum. It's the best way I could describe it. If the zoo was with humans and we're acting feral, you know, attacking each other, throwing feces, you know, getting naked, doing the most feral, savage things, you're going to see that on Skid Row. And you're going to see, you know, broken, fractured individuals laying in the street, open air narcotics dealings, prostitution, everything's up front. There's nothing, very little things covert, everything's over. And it's just, I'll put it this way, my old man, you know, New York City guy, you know, his whole life, you know, Vietnam vet. And when I took him down there on a tour, he was shocked. And my old man's seen a lot. He's like, wow, I've never seen something like this in my life. And yeah, I was used to it. I was like, really? He's like, you know, this kind of, you know, put you on your heels. He's like, wow, this is terrible. And for him to say that, for what he's seen, it says a lot. It said a lot to me. So,
yeah. What's the like rough estimate of population down there?
Oh, I'm not a numbers guy. That's why I became a cop. I don't know what the population is down there. All I know is it's too much. You know, we're supposedly a first world country, and you go down there, and it looks like a fourth world if there's one that exists.
It's thousands of people, though, right?
Thousands, yeah. It's horrible. It's, you know, because we get people from all over the country down there, and people that were, you know, born and reared in L.A. So it's a disgrace. I mean, it should never happen, and we should never point the fingers at other countries and, you know, people coming here from other lands, you know, to make a better life, like, until we fix up our own backyard. And it's horrible.
And is there even anything else in the U.S. that's even comparable to that?
You know what? The Lower East Side in New York City used to have, like, the Bowery, it used to be called back in the day. So I remember that in the 70s. And but it's just, yeah, there's really nothing to that level and that intensity. I mean, every major city is going to have its really hard, intense, poverty-ridden places. But the way it's contained, where it's contained and allowed to breed and get bigger and bigger, I haven't seen. I've been fortunate to travel a lot. I haven't seen it to that degree.
Yeah. So when you deal with these kind of like disturbing and terrible things you see, you know, pretty much on a day-to-day basis, what do you do when you get away from work? How do you decompress and get your mind off of things?
Doing things like this, communicating with good, healthy, like-minded individuals, and trying to stay as physically fit as possible. I just got back from doing a high-intensity interval training for an hour. Then I went to get a chiropractor adjustment and a massage. Went to coffee with a good friend of mine, doing a podcast, and then later on, you know, I'll see what happens, go down to the ocean or whatever. So just trying to, for every negative thing, you got to fill it with something positive. So just trying to do jiu-jitsu. I got tomorrow morning. I've been doing Gracie jiu-jitsu for like the last 3 years or so, playing guitar, playing bass, playing drums in the future. A buddy of mine's giving me an electronic drum kit. Reading, everything I did as a kid, you know, playing music, you know, reading, and hanging out with good people that they can enhance my lifestyle instead of bringing me down. So,
yeah, you mentioned my next question was actually, I know you're a big reader. What are some of the books like when you were younger that really kind of captured your imagination?
Yeah, one of the books that I read that really got me open was G. Gordon Liddy. He wrote an autobiography called Will. And it's just crazy. You know, he had an unbelievable childhood, and then he was in the Army, then went to the FBI, did his thing in the FBI, and then ended up, you know, working under the Nixon administration and Watergate, and then going to prison, going to jail. He was in the DC jail, which back in the 70s, I'm sure now, it's just as ill. I mean, it was wild what he did in jail and how he survived and how he thrived, you know, and a lot of it was mindset. You know, that was pretty much all of it. Will, hence the title Will. And so I always gravitated to those individuals that thrived in chaos, and it came out better for it. So I kind of always liked that rogue element, but for the right reasons, and just persevering through all the madness. And so that was a big one. And then police-wise, there was a book called Prince of the City by, I believe his last name was Daly. And it chronicles a 70s narcotics detective named Bob Lucci, which ended up befriending later on in his life before he died. And he was a corrupt narcotics detective and then kind of went through a redemption process and started working undercover to combat, you know, the narcotics trade and other corrupt narcotics detectives. And so really coupled with the book, the movie of the same thing. And it was a lot of great lessons in that of, you know, how to avoid those temptations in life and just how to be a top-notch detective. Mm-hmm. and staying away from that type of element that could corrupt you. So
the movie's like, oh, sorry to interrupt you. The movie's like roughly like 1980-ish, isn't it? Or late 70s, is that right?
Princess City, yeah, maybe 80, 81,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What are some of your, I know you love true crime stuff too, just from your posts. What are some of your favorite true crime books from when you were younger all the way up till today? Are there a couple that really stick out?
Oh, definitely from younger till today, anything by TJ English. The first one I read was The Westies. And that was just unbelievable because I never heard about these guys growing up. Long story short, you know, it's Irish-American mafia based in the Hell's Kitchen, which was a rough and tumble neighborhood in New York City, which is now, you know, just yuppies and just a regular rich neighborhood now. It doesn't resemble anything like that, but it was all hard scrap Irish kids and on the wrong side of the tracks, literally, and coupled with the Italian mafia. And they were kind of like they're off the books, you know, hitmen and, you know, doing things that they couldn't do themselves. And they would contract out to the West Side Boys there. And that book was unbelievable. It was, you know, had the best of both worlds. It had like the Irish cops against, you know, the Irish hoods. So it was unbelievable. And TJ English is just he has a great writing style. It's very direct, very raw, but it's very, I think it's unbiased. So check out anything that he's done true crime wise. And he just nailed it from so many different angles, whether it's Cuban Americans in the 70s, you know, Irish cats. One of the best, I think my favorite novel from him is this book called Born to Kill. It's about the Vietnamese gangs, refugees that came here after the fallout from the Vietnam War that set up in Chinatown in New York City and started doing home invasions and all types of wild shit back in New York. And it's fascinating. But, you know, we don't really see much about Vietnamese gangs in the media or in print, really. So it was a great eye-opener.
He's actually done the podcast 3 times. He's been nice enough to do it three
That's
times.
Right.
And like, he's one of my favorites too. He's awesome. I can't wait to see what he's going to come out with next. I don't have any clue, but I'm sure it'll be cool.
I know. He knocks it out of the park all the time. Since he's done the podcast 3 times, he's a very gracious individual. You know, if he comes in town, get a cigar, or, you know, whatever, get some coffee somewhere. He's just a good guy. So that makes it even better.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about Prince of the City. I was going to say that the LAPD has such an interesting history. Are there any other books or movies that you feel kind of capture the LAPD accurately? Do you think Colors is a good representation, or is it?
The gang stuff now is a little dated, you know, it's a little, exploitive maybe, but that was a good, you know, good snapshot of how we handled business in the 80s and early 90s. Heat is a huge favorite. That shows more of the upper echelon of detectives as far as like working high profile crews, like burglary crews or robbery crews. And that dealt with the robbery homicide division and the special investigations section. That's our surveillance unit. Anything by Michael Mann, who directed that one, is going to be super as authentic and accurate as a movie can be. There's no movie that's accurate out there because it's not a documentary. It's just for entertainment. So a lot of guys get wrapped up and, oh, you know, we wouldn't be, firing H&K rifles. You know, it's like, all right, you get put that stuff out of the way. But, you know, some of the tactics and the techniques and the procedures are pretty dead on in almost every Michael Mann film. So that definitely rang true for LA's crime fighting techniques and the way of going about doing business for sure. So
this is not so much to do with police work, but I watched Boulevard Nights again not too long ago, like within the past few months. And I think that movie came out in like 78 or 79, right around there. Is that, and that's about East LA gangs. And is East LA still pretty much like what's East LA like these days?
It's starting to get gentrified on the outside as downtown LA has been built up and it's been populated with a really young, more affluent population. You know, rents increased, property increased, so it started pushing out people and they started drifting into East LA, which is adjacent to downtown LA. They're like, yeah, let's check this out, go past the LA River. And so you get a little bit of that, but primarily East LA is still East LA. I mean, it's like the hardcore bastion of, you know, that Mexican American Chicano culture. So it's pretty true to what you see nowadays. Obviously the gang element's completely different. You know, you don't see these guys traditionally where people think like you know, guys with shaved heads running around with Dickies and white beaters on the lab. Yeah. And now it's a little bit more, it's not as overt anymore. It's a little bit covert. You'll see these guys, they look like skateboard kids, but they're some of the stone cold killers, you know, with multiple notches on their belt of homicides and won't think twice of shooting a cop or, you know, putting down a rival or someone that gets in their way.
Yeah. Back to books for 1 second. I know you're connected with Stuart Neville, who is an crime writer from Northern Ireland. How did you get hooked up with him, and what? How did you help him out with his book?
Yeah, we met in LA. There's a LA Times book festival, which is fantastic, and they did a lot of readings and signings and what have you. Just a huge 3 or 4 day event, I believe. And you don't see a lot of authors, you know, making an impact here from, you know, the north of Ireland out here. And somehow I got hooked onto his books. And one of his main characters in his crime saga is same surname as mine. Mm. So that made it even cooler. So I ended up meeting him at one of these book events, and we just struck up a conversation. And I believe he hit me up for a business card. He said, "Hey, if you ever got something going on in the future, you got to hit you up." I said, "Yeah, sure." I mean, I was raised on, literary background, and that was my babysitters were books, and I worked at a library in college, so I always had a close, connection to that world. So anything I could do to help out an author, and so he did hit me up, and ended up working on a book as a technical advisor. So anything police related or courtroom related, he would hit me up, and I would give him the feedback of what was legit, what wasn't, and, how to craft it somewhat. So, and he's a fellow music head as well, big guitarist, same as I am. And so we're in that same demographic. We love all the same things. So,
yeah. And I like his books a lot.
He's a solid guy. And it's just a different perspective. I mean, even visiting over there, it's just, completely different mentality from the US. So,
have you been to Belfast before?
Yes. I loved it. I think it's the best, for me, it was the best part of Ireland on my trip. I just felt I felt like I was back home in Queens. Felt very much like my old neighborhood, and the people couldn't have been any nicer. It's amazing. Kind of like in South Central, there's an affinity for the people down there. Anything where people have a lot of strife and chaos, usually a lot of, once you get past the superficial, differences, they're very engaging. People say, like, "Wow, you came down here, or you work down here. We really appreciate that." So you go to visit that, they take that, heavily. Like, "Wow, you came from the U.S. to Belfast? Why?" Like, I'm like, "Why not? It's just for this. For great people." Like, to the point of, something ridiculous. Like, I ended up back when I used to drink, I went to one of the pubs out there called Madden's, and they closed the bars early. They're like 11 or 12 o'clock. Ended up staying at like 4 or 5 o'clock. It was so generous. And just, talking to all the patrons and everyone else that was still left behind there. And my hotel was only, like, I think maybe 3 blocks away. And so as I was leaving, they're like, "How are you going to get home?" I said, "Oh, the hotel's right a couple blocks away." They're like, no, we'll walk you back." I'm like, "No." It's like, "Oh, fine. And I wasn't inebriated or whatever. I was completely, fully functioning. But they were so hospitable. Like, no, it's dangerous out here." And I'm like, "It's not dangerous out here." I said, "I'm good." And they were so nice and endearing. The bartender walked me back to my hotel. Super nice guy. Asked the cabbie for directions. The guy got out of his cab, since he saw that I didn't understand his directions, because their streets are totally different from ours. Like, every street, if you can go a mile, and the name will change like 4 times. It's wild. So he saw that I wasn't on the same directions. He walked me to my destination. Even though we had a cab, he just wanted to talk and walk. So, yeah, I can't say enough good things about people from those type of environments where they've seen war and tragedy and death. And it's a good bonding experience for visitors or people that work there. And, salt of the earth, usually. So,
yeah. All right, last thing I wanted to talk to you about is something that we both enjoy doing, and it's finding locations of movies, movie locations, TV, pop culture, history, crime. And, we both post stuff up on the Delta Bravo Urban Exploration team, which you started with Danny Boy O'Connor. How did you two originally get hooked up?
We met initially at, there's an iconic director named Kenneth Anger. And he's the type of director that Martin Scorsese and all the directors that we love, like, bow down to. Very, does a lot of cultish type movies and abstract avant-garde things. And he was doing a thing in downtown LA, and we met up there, started talking, quickly learned that we had a lot of the same interests, and made a plan to visit Charles Manson's Spahn Ranch. Went down there together, hooked up again, and, you know, started exploring, and then it was off to the races from there. We all love the same stuff, you know, and just found that, you know, we had a lot of free time at the time of driving around, having coffee, and, you know, BSing with each other, and scouting out music locations, true crime locations, and what have you. And it all goes back to, you know, looking for that that brotherhood, and that's what I found in Danny. And then it goes back to, so like the French Connection with my old man, that was filmed in our neighborhood. And as I would go walk around with my old man and go for an ice cream or whatever, while he threw down a couple of pints, he would point out where the Archie Bunker house was on the street that we lived in, you know, the opening credits to All in the Family, and then showed me all where French Connection was filmed, and where Phil Rizzuto from the Yankees lived two blocks away. So all these little tidbits of, you know, of pop culture knowledge I was doing, you know, as a very young age, and then found somebody else that liked the same, you know, crazy, wacky things that I loved, and was a fellow New Yorker. And then we just started putting it out on social media, and then people opened up to it and loved it just as much. So it became what it is today, just like a nice little fraternity of like-minded individuals. And it's been great.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. The first time I went to L.A. was I was 16, and I saw where they filmed Halloween, the Halloween house, which, yes, I think is on a street. I think the street's called Orange Grove.
Yes.
And I was just blown away. It was like, you know, I thought they filmed it in the Midwest somewhere or something, and it's like right off Sunset, like in a little neighborhood. But that's kind of what got my wheels turning when I was a teenager. And then first time I went to New York, I had to go see the Wonder Wheel from the Warriors on Coney Island. And so, yeah, I love that stuff. And that is a cool – Delta Bravo has turned into a cool community on Facebook and Instagram for sure.
Absolutely.
One last question. What are like the Holy Grail locations that you're still looking for that you haven't been able to – you and Danny Boy maybe haven't been able to find yet?
We haven't been able to confirm or really find. There's a like a, I don't know how you categorize, like a food stand, taco, Mexican, Cuban sandwich place that's in Scarface. Like one of the opening scenes where Tony Montana's working is basically just a laborer at that place. Yeah. And then he gets hit up, and then he's quits. He throws a towel at his boss, and he's like, guy's like, hey, man, you got a lot of dishes to clean. And he takes the towel and hits him in the face. He's like, wash them yourself, man. So we suspect that's in downtown LA in like Little Tokyo. But, you know, the landscape has changed so much downtown. Buildings have been raised. So it's really tough to confirm that. I've got some reasonable suspicion on it. But that's definitely one of them for sure.
I didn't realize they filmed some of Scarface in LA. I thought it was all Miami.
It was a good portion. I think Oliver Stone, which is one of my other favorite directors, he was like persona non grata since he was poking around and everyone found out about Scarface. And back then it was still going on, all that activity. So the legend goes he got bounced out of there and had to finish shots in LA. So there's a lot of Scarface in LA. We masked it very, very well, like the Freedom Town. That's on the 110 and 10 freeway, and Montana Realty, a bank, I think it was, or whatever. There's a lot of good scenes that are in Los Angeles. Usually you could tell by the daylight, the lighting really is very bright in Los Angeles, obviously due to the sunshine, and that's usually a giveaway. That, and there's these red, like, I don't even know what color curbs, but if you look in LA movies, there's always like almost like a blood red curb. That's like the red zone for parking indication, and that's everywhere, and that's very LA indicative. I don't think many other cities have that. So that's always a dead giveaway I look for to see if it's filmed in LA.
Yeah. All right. Well, next time I'm in LA, hopefully we can do the ride along if you guys do that kind of thing.
Sure. I just did one the other day with a fellow podcaster, forensic psychologist called Shiloh. She has a thing called LA Not So Confidential, and I took her out on the ride along. So all podcasters are welcome, you know, if you pass the litmus test, and you definitely have, Matt. So you got an open invite to roll with us. It's going to be early, 5 a.m. We start hitting doors. So,
Do you have any like summer travel plans? You going to Tulsa at all, or anything, coming up?
Yeah, I was going to visit Danny at least like every three months, but you know, due to COVID, it's changed plans a bit. So, yeah, I'm definitely hopefully getting out to Montana to do another podcast with someone, a guy named Andy Stumpf, Navy SEAL. Is a great podcast called Cleared Hot, and then hopefully you know check out Danny again and see Tulsa. So it seems like it changes every couple of months. There's some you know getting bigger and better. So yeah, I got some little trips planned in the upcoming months. See how it goes. Hopefully all this stuff is in the past as far as this travel stuff. So
yeah, have you seen the Outsider's House the finished product yet? I haven't.
Oh yeah, it's from the very beginning. So. You know, present day, yeah, it's unbelievable to see what he's done with the place. It's unbelievable. So good.
I'm driving to Kansas this summer, and I'm thinking I have to make a detour because I haven't seen the – I saw it 2 years ago when he was still working on it. I stopped by to say hi, but I need to see everything. And I got to see my brick.
Absolutely, yeah. So. Yeah. That's going to be – I mean, just to see yourself, you know, the Outsider's House Museum is unbelievable, but the town itself and, again, the people – but what make that such a great place. So yeah. You're in for a special treat.
Catch a mean dose of my fist. Homeboy, you get dissed. Guess who's back?